it's too late. It's very different for the believer and for the non-believer. What we're told in the Ahadith is that when the angels enter the grave, how they look is very terrifying. So imagine, as I said, the state of that person who's now just been transitioned out from this world. But then now to be over there, and then suddenly these two angels come in. Some of the ahadith are very graphic with what happens to that person. It is said that they strip the mayyit of the kafan. They sit the mayyit up. And after that, the questioning begins. Imam Ali, in that hadith that I mentioned, it says that the mayyit is trying to whisper, kind of. They don't want to get the questions wrong, but they're rapid-fire questions by the angels. The angels, it's mentioned that they have voices like thunder, and their eyes are like blinding lightning. There's other details that they mention about the angels, about their fangs, about their hair dragging on the ground. There's other details that are mentioned about a shaitan being entering into the grave. Snakes being unleashed on the mayyit if the person doesn't answer in the right way. All of these different things happening. And so that's what happens when the person is there. And then they start to go over and ask the questions. So right now, these first questions are about the preliminary beliefs, because the details are going to come later. Later on, for instance, let's say over here that we can ask about prayer and fasting and these kind of things, just the basics of it. Over there, then Allah will say, for instance, when you offered Dhuhr prayer, what niyyat did you have? Right? Because there's another hadith that I had shared with brothers and sisters before where they said, on the day of judgment, then there's 50 stations, and each one of those stations is 1,000 years. Inna lil qiyama khamsina mawqifa. There's 50 stations on the day of judgment. Kullu mawqifin miqdaruhu alfa sana. Each mawqif, each station is 1,000 years. And that's where they go over each and every detail that the person did. Of course, unless the believer was able to do enough in this world, so there's one of those people who answers without hisab, because there are some people who are like that. There's some people who are going to, but they're doing it here. They're taking care of it on this side. They don't want to face those nightmares on the other side. But otherwise, what happens is that preliminary interrogations happens here, and the basics that the angels are asking are things about our belief. Who's our Lord? Who's our Creator? What's our deen? And it's mentioned that the beating starts for those who are rejecting, those who don't answer correctly. The beating starts. Now, what we want to talk about is, inshallah, what happens if we're believers? Inshallah, we're amongst the good people. Inshallah, we're amongst those who are able to take care of our affairs before we go there, and not have to face those horrors on the other side. Because the things that we're going to be facing are going to be our beliefs. What were our beliefs? Were they in line with Quran and Sunnah or not? Our actions? Inshallah, we'll get a chance to talk about what are some of the main reasons that people get those squeeze in the grave. If we were to know some of those things, we'd be able to avoid them. But anyhow, for the believer, we're told that the angels look very different. Imam Sadiq in one hadith, he tells, they ask, a man named Abu Basir asks the Imam, he says, do the angels, nakir and munkar, do they look the same for the mu'min and the kafir? And the Imam says, no. Actually, one of those du'as, the things that we're advised for the month of Rajab, one of those beautiful du'as that we make, and now is the time, meaning the time of Ramadan is when we can make these kind of du'as, where we ask Allah to save us from the interrogation. And instead of us seeing nakir and munkar, that we see the angels who are giving good tidings. So that can happen. The angels look very different. So first of all, for the believers, we're told that, inshallah, we're amongst these people. The believers are escorted. When they first die, they're escorted by the malaika. So first of all, alhamdulillah, they saw Ahlul Bayt when they died. After that, they're escorted by the malaika. The earth gives good tidings to them, to the believer who's about to be buried. Now, the other thing that happens is that the angels are very happy. Nakir and Munkar, they're happy when we give the right answers. The angels are on our side. They want us to win. After we answer correctly, just that preliminary discussion, then the angels tell us, ثَبَّتَكَ فِيمَا تُحِبْ وَتَرْضَى, that may Allah make you stay firm on those things that you love and that you're pleased by. We're also told that there's a call that comes from heaven for the believers. That caller that comes from heaven speaks on behalf of Allah, says, Sadaqa abdi, my slave has told the truth. And then they're told to put down carpet for the believer from paradise. In addition to that, they're told to open a door to paradise, and also that the person should be able to wear those heavenly garments. And then after that is when the angels end up expanding the grave of the believer until it gets so as far as the eye can see. And then after that also, the door to heaven. So we ask Allah, inshallah, to help us to be amongst those people who are able to pass this first test of the angels, the interrogation of the angels, and inshallah, have the comfort and the help of the Ahlul Bayt in doing so.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you. This is for a better life.
فرمود باعث تو لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. One of the most fundamental things for a human being on the way to perfection and to achieving happiness is to know that he is created by Allah for a certain purpose. There are different approaches to this matter. In Islam, every person is first of all invited to study this problem and make a certain judgment about it. Nothing less than certainty of belief in Allah is acceptable. Everyone is invited in this world to conduct his own personal research on where he came from and where he belongs to and what is his origin. And of speaking of our origin, this is a very, difficult question, but it's not difficult to answer. Because if we just think, if we go to our fitrah, we will understand that we do not belong to this world. We are from divinity, we are from Allah, and to Him we return. There are different ways to prove the existence of Allah in a variety of reasons. Of course, Allah is our origin. But according to Islam, it is not a difficult process to understand that Allah is existent. Everyone at every level of knowledge and understanding can settle this problem easily. Usually when a person is a disbeliever, it is because of his will. Although there might be rare cases of people who have studied this problem seriously and who were really longing for the truth, but they couldn't find it. And usually atheism is just an assumption.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Take this verse which I'm reciting into consideration. أَفِاللَّهِ شَكٌّ فَاطِرِ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ. Is there doubt about Allah, the maker of the heavens and the earth? Verse 10 of chapter 14. There are many verses in the Holy Quran indicating that there were certain groups of people who were sure about the truth of the teachings of the Prophet, but they denied. وَجَحَدُوا بِهَا وَاسْتَيْقَنَتْهَا أَنفُسُهُمْ ظُلْمًا وَعُلُوًّا. And they denied them, though their souls acknowledged them, they denied them wrongfully and out of pride. Pharaoh, for example, Fir'aun, was denying Allah and was claiming divinity for himself. He was saying that Ana Rabbukum al-A'la, I'm your supreme Lord. He was so proud of himself. He was unjust, of course. But in the heart of heart, he knew he was not a Lord. Disbelief in Allah is mainly a moral problem rather than epistemological one. There have been some people who had been accustomed to a certain kind of life and they had comfort in that way of life, of course. So they could not give up their post and their way easily and observe what the prophets invited them to. Instead of thinking and reasoning, they made fun of the prophets and attributed to them such things as madness and magic. They thought, perhaps unconsciously, that if they denied them for once, they would be free for all their lives. In Islam, every value is due to the relation with Allah. Our happiness, our better life, our felicity, our bliss is based on our voluntary devotion to Allah. It is like the lives of plants and animals which depend on the light of sun. The sun does not need them, but they cannot survive without the sun. Our life is the life of a flower in relation to the sun. We also need God, and it's not true to say that God needs us.
Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oasis. We built buildings of different heights and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we'd paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Those people who had studied religion, they would have found the reality. On the Day of Judgment, of course, they will say, وَقَالُوا لَوْ كُنَّا نَسْمَعُ نَاقِلْ مَا كُنَّا فِي أَصْحَابِ السَّعِيرِ. And they shall say, had we but listened or pondered, we should not have been among the inmates of the burning fire. We believe in Allah, who is the wise. He has created the whole universe for us and has created us to get nearer and nearer to Him. And of course, Allah is the beneficent, the merciful. He is kinder to us than our parents. He is also the most knowing. This is Allah, who is the benevolent and at the same time absolutely needless. Of course, we must be proud of having such a Lord. We must try our best to understand His advice, which is embodied in the pure religion, Islam, of course. If a people has the best master, his ultimate honor is to take his advice and direct his attention towards him, and finally, to be like him. And Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam has been reported to have said, إِلَهِ كَفَى بِي عِزًّا أَنْ أَكُونَ لَكَ عَبْدًا وَكَفَى بِي فَخْرًا أَنْ تَكُونَ لِي رَبًّا أَنْتَ كَمَا أُحِبُّ فَاجْعَلْنِي كَمَا تُحِبُّ. O my God, it suffices me as glory to be your servant, and it suffices me as honor to have you as my Lord. You are what I love, so make me what you love. In Islam, every value is due to the relationship with Allah. Our happiness is based on our voluntary devotion to Him. It is like the lives of plants and animals, as I said, which depends on the life of the sun. The sun does not need them, but they cannot survive without the sun. We should change the common approach to divine law or commands. They are not some boring duties assigned to us by Allah in exchange for His favors or His services or for His bounties to us. We are not to perform His commands in response to His blessings. We should know that His commands are only for our benefit. His religion, His prophets, and His laws are the most precious blessings that we have ever received. So we must be thankful to Allah for the benefits, for the services, for the favors that Allah did to us. وَإِذْ تَأَذَّنَ رَبُّكُمْ لَإِنْ شَكَرْتُمْ لَأَزِدَنَّكُمْ. And when your Lord makes it known, if you are grateful, I would certainly give to you more. So, لَإِنْ شَكَرْتُمْ لَأَزِدَنَّكُمْ. If you are grateful, then we will increase your bounty, we will increase your blessings. So, dear brothers and sisters, if we are thankful, we increase our capacity to receive more blessings. The more we are thankful, the more we are grateful to Allah, the more our capacity to receive more blessings increases. With more thankfulness, again more blessings will be brought. It is an endless process. If you are not thankful, it's not harmful to Allah, but decreases our capacity for receiving His blessings. So we lose some blessings, and if we continue, we will lose more. That's all for this episode. Until next session, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, He knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, He knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, He knows. Every
share, he knows. Allah knows.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture, everyone. First part of the documentary witnessed the rise and fall of gold used as currency throughout human civilization, from first gold coins in Lydia to their dominance of over 1,000 years in the Byzantine Empire. But what role does gold play in the modern international economic arena, and how has it made a comeback after the dollar took over for about half a century?
Under the gold standard, in which money is issued based on the reserved gold, the prices of commodities are more stable because the government cannot simply issue more money. Also, trade deficits remain under control. Trade deficits under the gold standard refer to the effect of domestic gold transferring over to other countries due to an increase in revenue. If there is less gold, less money is issued. With less money, consumption and income automatically decrease. Export relatively increases, and the country sees a surplus in trade. Under the gold standard, the value of money is very stable, unless the amount of gold drastically increases. However, because of this, the gold era collapsed. The gold standard, in which issued money is tied to gold. When the economy began to grow rapidly, thanks to the Industrial Revolution, the amount of money needed to grow as well. However, because of the limited amount of gold, sufficient amount of money could not be issued. This problem became more evident during World War I. The countries that participated in the war had to issue large sums of money to fund the war. One by one, they began to discard the gold standard.
1929, Black Tuesday.
The gold standard faced another crisis during the Great Depression. As countries began to exchange foreign currency for gold in fear of the never-ending depression, it led to disputes over gold.
As it has endured,
we'll revive and we'll prosper.
In 1933, President Roosevelt nullified the gold standard, and more countries began to discard it. After World War II, the world's gold gathered in the U.S., and the gold standard was gradually disappearing. In 1944, each country's representative gathered in Bretton Woods, USA. 44 countries participated, but it was actually a battle between England and the U.S., and in the end, the U.S. won. Since then, the dollar became the key currency of the world. It was a defining moment for the U.S., as it became the empire of finances. However, during the Vietnam War, the dollar faced a crisis. More money was issued to fund the war, which led to increased prices and deficits. When the value of the dollar plunged, each country began to ask for gold conversion. It was the first crisis that the dollar had faced. In 1971, U.S. President Nixon declared the prohibition of gold conversion. He no longer allowed exchanging dollars for gold. Along with the Nixon shock, the era of gold ended and the Bretton Woods Agreement collapsed. The financial system in use today is the result of the Nixon shock. The U.S. is still home to the largest economy, maintains the dollar as the international currency, and other countries put their destinies in the hands of the dollar. The U.S., which had abandoned gold, now had the power to issue as many dollars as they wanted. The Asian financial crisis in 1997 that drove Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Korea to the edge of a cliff was the result of the U.S. recklessly issuing dollars. The reckless printing of the dollar can threaten any given country. This is all possible because of the absence of gold as a standard. The gold and the dollar, which were linked together at one point, now were on diverging paths. The ups and downs of civilizations and currency have a special relationship. If a strong civilization appears, its currency becomes strong as well, and if the currency value falls, the civilization also wanes. Whether they were coins or paper money, overissuance of money always led to the collapse of an empire.
A powerful government means powerful economy. The reason why the government is powerful because the economic system is so strong and the people work hard, make money, pay the tax. So the government can get more and more tax, which has a lot of wealth and a lot of spending power, which keep the government strong, keep the country or empire strong. But why such system can have a stronger economy compared to others? I think money is a big issue. It's a very important.
Ancient Rome is the representative case where the empire's history followed the ups and downs of currency. Once ancient Rome expanded to the Mediterranean Sea, the circulation range of the currency did as well. The expansion of the local currency led to stronger national power through the acquisition of local resources. Periods of stable prices and a booming economy coincide with the peak of the Roman Empire. In 54 AD, the peaceful reign of the Roman Empire ended under Emperor Nero. Nero reduced the amount of gold used in coins and made thinner, smaller ones. His successors also degraded the coins, and the value of money plunged. The currency system completely collapsed, and the government had to collect taxes through goods and services instead of money. The strong empire had reverted back to the time of the exchange of goods. In 476 AD, the thousand-year-old civilization of the Roman Empire collapsed. Even after the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire continued to flourish and survived for another 1,000 years. The secret to the survival of the Byzantine Empire, despite frequent battles, was the bezant, the Byzantine coin. However, after the Crusades, even the value of the bezant plunged. In 1453, the Byzantine Empire fell when the last bezant was used up. The Byzantine Empire disappeared along with the bezant, and the Ottoman Turks became the rulers of a new empire. The special relationship between the fall of a currency and an empire can also be seen in China. During the Buxong dynasty, people in Sichuan made coins out of iron. At the time, about 20,000 iron coins were needed to buy a roll of fabric. A carriage was needed just to buy a roll of fabric. So in order to solve this problem, the world's first paper money, Gilja, was invented using iron coins as collateral. However, 100 years later, due to the government's over-issuance of money, the world's first paper money disappeared. Once the currency system collapsed, the Song dynasty lost its military and political power and collapsed under the Mongolian invasion. The Yuan dynasty that watched the Song dynasty's fall issued gyocho, based on silver, and created a stable currency system. However, the problem was the endless wars. Every time it faced financial difficulties, the government overissued gyocho, and the currency system collapsed. Once the currency system collapsed, the Yuan dynasty fell like all other empires. The national crisis shook the trust in currency, and the failure of the currency system led to the collapse of an empire. A strong currency and a strong empire were the two pillars that drove history. New York, USA. The Federal Reserve Bank on Wall Street houses the world's largest gold safe. In the 122 gold safes that are located 24 meters underground is gold that other governments, central banks, and international organizations entrusted. After the gold standard disappeared, gold that lost its place to the dollar disappeared into the dark. Then, what backs the value of currency? It's the world's key currency that is the foundation of international trade and transactions. The source of that power is in national strength. The British pound dominated the world's economy for 100 years, and then the US dollar took over. It was the result of the currency war among nations.
Oftentimes, over time in history, you find that as countries change in their economic power, the UK and then the US, reserve currencies change. But I think we're moving to a world where there's a lot more engines of growth, and it makes sense to have multiple reserve currencies. So this is a function not just of the United States, but really of the changing world economy. But it does mean, though, for the United States, if other currencies are used as reserve holdings, then there will be a relative fall in the demand for the dollar as a foreign exchange reserve holding, and that's worrisome if the U.S. has a lot of debt to sell.
The Byzantine bezant, 700 years. The British pound, 100 years. These are the number of years these key currencies dominated the world. Then how much longer will the dollar rule the world? People's fantasy about the dollar shattered in September 2008. The financial crisis that originated from the U.S. left the world in fear, and people immediately rushed to obtain gold. The moment greed turned to fear, the emperor, sleeping in the dark, awoke from its slumber. After 40 years of sleep, gold has returned. The price of gold rose 22 times in 2010, which is a record within a given year. Now the world is rushing out to buy gold. The central banks of each country bought 216 tons of gold just in the first half of 2011. The price of gold is skyrocketing, and the US and the dollar is plunging endlessly.
Even before the financial crisis, there were trends underway which meant it made it likely that the US would not play as dominant a role in international finance as it has in recent decades. You had the creation of the euro, a currency for a very large economic area, and the euro was beginning to play a larger role. In addition, you've got the emergence of China, already the second largest economy in the world and growing very rapidly, that makes it natural that over time, as Chinese financial markets develop, as they open up their capital markets, then I think we will see the renminbi play a larger role as well.
Just as it defeated England at the Bretton Woods Conference, defeated France via the Nixon shock, put Germany and Japan under control, will the US be able to win the currency war once again?
Well, the United States is now in relative decline to the rest of the world. As you probably know, the 19th century was the century of the UK. It went into decline during the 20th century, and it's no longer anywhere near the major economy in the world. The 20th century was the century of the US. We're now in relative decline, too. The largest creditor nations in the world now are China, Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore. The assets and the money, the wealth, is in Asia now. The United States is the largest debtor nation, not just the largest debtor nation in the world, we're the largest debtor nation in the history.
Once the US, the financial empire built on debt and the power of the dollar, began to shake, the world began to debate about the new key currency. The one that's receiving the most attention is gold, that it has returned after 40 years. Is gold the omnipotent currency that will bring stability back, or is it just a mirage?
Well, the fundamental dilemma for somebody that's thinking of holding gold is that gold does not produce an income. Now, I mentioned art. art does not produce an income, but it gives you a mental income, it gives you a psychological income. Common stocks, equities, or bonds, they give you a financial income. Gold doesn't do that. What gold does do is it gives you some security.
So as it stands today, we think gold is undervalued by a pretty good margin. We don't know if 10,000 is the target, but we do think that the difference between $1,500 and $10,000 an ounce represents the degree of inflation, true inflation, that we've seen in the currency. Now, if we were to use the same formula that we used from 1945 to 1971, the price of gold would be $10,000 an ounce.
Gold versus the dollar. The currency war has already begun. Gold is stable, but its production is limited. On the other hand, the dollar, with no restriction in production, has lost its stability. The gold standard was discarded 40 years ago after the Nixon shock. Will the era of gold return?
So I don't see gold coming back anytime soon. But if we had a serious crisis and there was nothing else, people might grab for the gold standard. But remember, the gold standard has many flaws as well.
I do not see gold playing an official part of a formal payment system. It's not convenient to exchange. It's not as stable in value as a basket of national currencies.
I think there's a pretty good chance that the gold standard will come back, although timing is a very difficult thing to try to handicap. It may come as a result of policy, but in practical terms, it's probably going to be the marketplace that drives the gold standard back into widespread acceptance.
The new key currency that will follow the British pound of the 19th century and the dollar of the 20th century. The birth of a new key currency begins from people's trust. In the midst of the world economic crisis, we are at a point where we must decide the future key currency.
Gold actually is not a government decision. We use this as a money. I think gold in the history, it's been chosen by the market. People trust gold. So when the people trust that gold or silver, so the government just use that as the money. If that's the case, I think probably in the future or in the current world, probably we should let the market to choose which one is better solution for our current problem.
No one knows which currency to trust and which currency to choose as the key currency. But even at this moment, gold reflects humans' desire most accurately. A soft, yellow, sparkling piece of metal. It is gold that the universe created. But humans gave it power, honor, and immortality. And the destiny of gold changed. Gold has written history for thousands of years. And humanity abandoned gold 40 years ago. But gold has returned. Will the return of gold be a blessing or a disaster? We stand before gold once again.
Well, with increasing political instability inside the U.S. and with the aftermath of the economic meltdown, perhaps the days of the dollar are in decline. And as history has proven to previous empires, when the dollar is out, U.S. dominance around the world will also fade away. Well, that's a wrap for this week. But join me again here next time on Aperture. If you have questions and comments you'd like to share with us, just email or visit our Facebook or Twitter. Goodbye for now.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at an important question. This is a question related to history, Islamic history, and specifically it's related to the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And that question is this: why is it that after Imam Ali formally accepted the reins of the government through the pressure of the people of Medina after the death and the murder of Usman, why is it that he chose the city of Kufa specifically to be the capital of the Islamic Empire and the center of his government? We know that there are two major cities in the Islamic world which hold great importance geographically and spiritually, religiously, that is, those are the cities of Medina and the city of Mecca. So, in the time of the Prophet, the city of Mecca was the capital of the Islamic world, the city of Medina and the city of Mecca. So why is it that Imam Ali decided to choose and change the capital to Kufa? One of the reasons why this was so was the special and distinct economic superiority of Iraq, you know, what is currently Iraq, and, you know, the city of Kufa specifically, over the Hijaz and the Arabian Peninsula. We're going to examine why this is so. First of all, as you know, the land of which is currently Iraq is, especially the city of Kufa, is very proximate and close to two very important rivers, which are the Dajla and the Furat, the Euphrates. And what is more, this area at that time, it possessed a lot of wells which had accessible drinking water. It gave people to accessible and drinkable water. For these two reasons, there was also large amounts of farms in which there was date palms, large gardens filled with fruit trees of fruits and dates and these kind of things. Because of that, the market, the great market of this city and other cities of this area, they were very big and very prosperous. So Imam Ali alayhi salam considered this area to be an economic and a bounteous a place. However, the land of Hijaz, the Arabian Peninsula, such as the cities of Mecca and Medina, these were more, they were less independent than the cities in Iraq and in the land of Iraq. Because, first of all, the area of the Hijaz was more drier, it was more an arid climate, and it was often seen that produce from farming would often dry up because of this reason. And it made it the life very economically very difficult for the people of the Hijaz. So they were more dependent on their wares coming from other cities. Because of this, the Imam realized that if he had made his government in the Hijaz, it would be more easier for his enemies to economically surround him and destroy him because of this. And for that reason, he chose the city of Kufa to be the center of his government. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the reason why Imam Ali chose Kufa as the city and center of his government. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi,
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights, and one of the most fundamental rights for human beings is to value life itself. Without valuing life itself, we can't move any further. Now, when we look at it from an Islamic perspective, or from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam specifically, we see that there is no doubt that life itself, in all of its forms, enjoys a very high status in Islam, which obviously was projected through Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salamullah. A human life obviously is one of the most sacred creatures of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Therefore, it needs to be appreciated, respected, and protected. Three things which Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi worked for: to appreciate life itself, to respect it, and also to protect it. And I think if we look at the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen from his childhood all the way until his martyrdom, that is the code that he lived by in dealing with people, and specifically in dealing with his enemies. So we need to look at it from an Islamic perspective, so we can understand how Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he himself went through that path, that maybe, inshallah, I and you could also have the same vision when we look at one another. So if you look at in Islam, life is considered to be one of the greatest gifts and blessings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And every moment of life has a great value, and therefore it must be appreciated, it must be protected. Even if it has poor quality, it doesn't matter. It's still, we can't come and say, well, that's a better human being, and that's a worse human being. That's a higher class of human being, and that's a lower class of higher human being. Even Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, when people used to come to him, those who obviously come from lineage and tribes and what have you, and they wanted to seek extra, to be favored on top of other people and seek extra wealth or extra, payment, Amir al-Mu'mineen always used to say to them that, last time I checked, that all human beings came from dust. So what makes you more superior? In fact, that's a satanic thinking, because Shaitan, he was the first to say, I am from fire and man is from mud, therefore I am a higher. I'm not going to prostrate to him. Sometimes we have this kind of thinking without realizing, whether it's consciously or subconsciously, we have that kind of thinking. Where Amir al-Mu'mineen constantly wanted to remind people that it's not. So even if the life of a human being, it doesn't matter who he is, where he is, or sometimes it's not just one person, sometimes it could be an entire tribe, an entire village, or entire country, where now, in our day, we classify them as third world countries, which means they are obviously less and they should not be giving any value. That is just, as horrible as it gets. And Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he stood against such notion and such ideology and such mentality. Now, before we continue, let us take a short break and then we will come back.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at English Radio at IRIB.org.